the fact that we really embrace play. In fact, we don't call it sex, we call it play, right? I say this all the time, is that in the vanilla world, you have hand jobs, you have blow jobs, you have rim jobs, you have jobs. In the key world, we have impact play and fire play, and we have fun. And we recognize the silliness and the joy that can come from connecting.
Hello, my name's Gay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So, I have never really been a very kinky person. Oh, this feels like I'm confessing to you. Dear Father, it's been 6 weeks since my last confession. I have never been a very kinky person. And worse than me not being a very kinky person is that I'm kind of interested in kink. And I'm one of those people who's always like, well, you know, if I met someone and they wanted to get kinky and show me stuff, then I would totally be down for it. But I'm far too lazy to be proactive and just go out there and find those experiences for myself. All of that might be changing though, because I keep having conversations with people who are involved in the kink scene and who've come to talk to me about kinky spaces and kinky nights, and it's kind of opening my eyes to it all a bit more. And I think the thing that resonates the most for me is that kink is a way of exploring yourself. It's not just about kind of like getting off and getting on with things. It's about being present in your body and about enjoying the moment and enjoying the connection that you have with the person or the persons, if you're lucky, that you are experiencing that moment with. And I think that's something that I could enjoy. All of this is to say that if I show up next week with a bunch of weird bruises on me, we don't really need to talk about it. The reason behind it will be pretty clear. All right, cool. Yeah, good, good. So let me introduce you to this week's guest. Her name is Auntie Vice, and she is the host of the Fat Girls on Top podcast. She is also a massive kinkster, and in this conversation, she tells me all about what drew her to that world, whilst introducing me to her lost space, Wicked Grounds, which was in San Francisco, USA. So shall we crack the whip and get on with it? That was a terrible joke, I'm sorry.
So I came out as queer to like the greater, broader world around 14. I had my first date with a girl at 12. And then, so to put it in context for your listeners, that was the mid 80s. So it's been quite a while. I will be 50 in April. But I always identified as bisexual. And I thought that's where most people fail, because that made sense to me. And that people who were exclusively one or another were on the ends, the abnormalities. And it took me a while to realize that for a lot of folks, both being 100% gay and 100% straight was seen as more normalized. And I'm not sure how I came to that conclusion, because I wasn't surrounded by bisexuals, but I was always just kind of okay being me. And coming out to my parents like wasn't a big deal. I came out because my father and I were in the car and fighting over how much time I was spending on the phone with friends. And he goes, well, what can you talk to your friends that you can't talk to your parents about? And I said, Dad, I'm bisexual and you don't know anything about that. Like, it was to shut him up, which worked. And at that point, my parents wanted to be very supportive. And again, this is mid and late 80s, which was not a great time to be an open queer youth on campus. I was like the only open gay kid in my entire school district. So my mom knew like one lesbian professor in her master's program and connected me with her. And
oh, when you were like 14.
Right.
Oh, well done, Mom.
Oh, yeah, I was a baby gay. And so instead of like going to prom at 16, I went to a big gay fundraiser because it was the first year they had a youth table.
Oh.
And they had found like 8 of us in the greater Bay Area to like come hang out. And I can remember listening to them joke about how, you know, Pride had started less than 10 years ago, and it was just like 12 people shouting, "Yay, we're gay," running around the block real fast, and then hiding out in somebody's garage for a brunch. Yeah, and there were no gay role models on TV or anything, but I was just like, yeah, I'm gay. It's just part of who I am. And so I knew all the gay kids on my campus. All of my dance dates were as a beard. I was always going as some gay guy's beard.
Okay, there's lots of follow-up questions I have here. The first one is about use of language. And this is just for me to understand. I'm not trying to police your language or anything. You've talked about being bisexual, but then you've also used the word gay quite a lot when you've been talking about yourself. Is there like no real distinction for you?
So for me, you know, when people ask, I identify as bisexual, and that of course has evolved, and we have like now 17 permutations of bisexuality.
Oh, I think we're actually up to 73 now.
Yeah, you may be correct on keeping up with use of the kids these days. But for me, I stay with that partly for political reasons, because when I came out, the B wasn't part of the L and the G.
Mm-mm.
I went to meetings with groups around California talking about whether or not we should add the B. Like, are they really gay enough? And so for me, for a long time, people didn't understand bisexuality. So I use gay, lesbian, whatever, to kind of fill in, because to say bisexual for so long was just, well, you just haven't committed. You're either really a lesbian or you're just experimenting. And there was such biphobia. I mean, there still is, but there was such strong biphobia. For a long time, I had to use all of those terms. And so I slip in and out. And I think part of that is just an age thing.
Okay. Oh, that's really helpful. Thank you. Then the other thing that I wanted to pick up on is your parents' response to everything. So you said in this kind of fit of anger or just to try and shut up your dad about the fact you were bisexual. But it seems as though very quickly they were in a point where they were like, oh, okay, we need to process this and we need to work through it. Can you talk to me a bit more about what happened after that car ride?
So he was quiet for the rest of the car ride. And as we're processing it, and as we're coming home, he says, well, do you want to tell your mother or you want me to do it? And I am a lazy teen here. And I said, well, you do it. Like, you take that burden. I don't need to do it. So he went upstairs and they had a protracted conversation and came downstairs. And clearly they weren't prepared for it. They should have been. Like, there were lots of signs. Like, at 4, when I saw Liberace on The Muppets Show, I decided my life's goal was to become his sidekick. So I demanded piano lessons and a fur coat.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a faux fur coat and piano lessons. I played piano competitively through high school. Because, like, being Liberace's sidekick was my dream.
Thanks to Liberace. Aww.
Well, and instead of playing house, I used to play committee. And so I'd sit my dolls around and we'd talk about a problem and vote on things. And we had agendas. So I don't know if you get more lesbian than that.
How is that a sign of being a lesbian?
We organize. I have so many call sheets and phone trees, and I am convinced we could never have just a pure lesbian bachelorette, because you put 12 lesbians in the room and we'll try to solve a problem. And we probably half of us have slept with each other.
But you weren't like a 6-year-old pressing your own tofu or anything. Like, so they couldn't tell immediately from just that you had committee and Liberace.
Yes, they didn't
pick obsessions.
You're right. There were signs. And so they did know that it was dangerous to be gay and to be out and open as being queer and bisexual and all of that, because the 80s were not a safe time and we're in the middle of the first wave of AIDS. So they wanted to make sure that I at least had somebody who had been through some of this to kind of guide me, because they couldn't. And they knew they couldn't. So they wanted to make sure their kids stayed safe, which was great. So yeah, they connected me with, you know, this professor, and then I discovered there was an LGBTQ bookstore in downtown San Jose, and I started going there avidly just to be around other queer people and queer literature, and I got my paperback mentors, you know, where I'm reading all of these different queer stories and going, oh my gosh, there's other people like me, which, you know, I think now with so much, especially in the States, of gay stories and queer stories under attack, and we're trying to keep the youth from finding out, is horribly detrimental, because that was my initial and deep connection, is people who had made it past the teen years, people who had experienced this. And I was able to see queer people on the page and know that there was a future. Mm.
Can we go back a step? Mm-hmm. So tell me about this professor that your mom helped you to meet. Do you remember the first time you met them?
Yes. So we initially talked on the phone, and I told her a little bit about myself. She was a social work professor, so very geared in counseling and all the lingo. And just, she was big on kind of assuring me that there was a community out there. There are people who care about this. And that was part of inviting me to the youth table at this gay fundraiser. It's like, we're here. There is a bigger world to get out into this world and connect, and like, you're not alone, which I think most queer kids is like the biggest part, is you're not going through this alone, and you get old. Like, I think, you know, I've heard a lot of, like, watching TikTok videos and stuff, a lot of queer kids are afraid that it's just their generation, or non-binary kids and all of that, that this is just them, but we've always been here. And I think knowing queer adults is really critical to that. And so just being able to get some books to read, and her advice of like, well, have you read this, or have you gone here? Like, and I mean, it was all age appropriate. Mm-hmm. We're not talking like the back room behind the Beaded Curtain bookstore. We're talking general queer work. So being able to have somebody kind of initially guide me and connect me to the community was a really big deal. It also probably kept me a lot safer than had I been trying to do this on my own.
And can we talk about you being out? You talked about being out at school. Did your parents know about that? And did they have any thoughts about it?
They were a little worried about bullying. I was not bullied. Part of that, I think, is my size. I'm 6 feet tall. And I am heavy set. In high school, I was a swimmer, so I had the really broad shoulders, really strong. Like, what other people thought of my personal life was never a huge concern. And I found very quickly being open about being gay meant other gay kids trusted me. So I had a pretty close circle of other kids who were not out, who were not open, but wanted to connect, wanted to talk, wanted to go to lunch or out on weekends. And so I was able to develop a pretty strong group of queer support kit, you know, group in school. Our school was very heavily controlled by gangs. I was on the wrong side of the tracks. And if you sold any type of drugs to me or whatever, you were the gay gang and you were okay with the gay kid. So I couldn't get drugs. I didn't go to any of those parties. My sister did. And my sister had a lot more issues with that. But for me, it was like, they all had to steer clear of me. Otherwise, they would be the gay gang.
Oh, interesting. So
in some ways, it gave me a little bit of protection.
I thought they would just want to sell to anyone.
No, no. They didn't want to appear to be okay with me.
Money's money.
It's the one place homophobia has worked in my favor.
And so you didn't have any problems being out then? It was just like an accepted thing in your school?
Yeah. And for a long time, all the way through college, people would say, well, there's boys, there's girls, and then there's Beck.
Wait, they didn't call you Auntie Vice?
Auntie Vice did not develop till my 30s. But yeah, there were boys, there were girls, and then there's me. And even though we didn't have words for gender nonconforming, non-binary, none of those words were out there, they knew I didn't fit into either category, and it was very clear. So it allowed me to get into spaces that were gendered, but it didn't have to be resonant with who I was. So I was in all male spaces. I was in all female spaces. I was in all gay spaces, all straight spaces. And I was able to code switch enough to move in between them mm-hmm. and see these different worlds. And to this day, that's how it is. Like, we have a leather bar in Sacramento, which isn't far from me. And when I started going, God, 20 years ago, it was all gay men. And women were not very welcome. But when I would walk in, there was always the split second of, wait, there's tits in a bar. And it's like, oh, no, it's just Auntie Vice. She'll give you blowjob tips on the back patio. Like, let her in. And I've been into, like, gay male sex clubs and stuff. And people don't, like, I don't present as male. But there's something that comes across that people know I'm okay in that space. I'm safe in that space.
What do you think that is?
The best way I've been able to describe it is like being liminal. I'm able to move between the soft places in the world. And I don't quite fit anywhere. But in that, I don't not fit anywhere.
So that kind of resonates with lots of queer people's experience, right? Like, they've had to find a way to either mm-hmm. be invisible in groups that they're in because they don't want to be singled out. So they found this way of just existing, and they can apply that skill to lots of different groups and lots of different spaces. And in some ways, that's wonderful because you get this exposure, you get this ability to be part of things and all things. You can just kind of like pick and choose what you want. But in other ways, it's really destabilizing because there's not any one place where you're like, yeah, this is my place. This is where I fit in, right?
Yeah. And for me, I never really felt like I had a tribe, a group that I really fit until I started hanging out with trans women.
Oh.
You know, in the last decade or so, I've had quite a few friends transition, and then they'll have, you know, gender reveal parties or, you know, that equivalent when they fully come into who they are. And I've been in groups of trans women, and I look like them. I'm tall, I'm bigger bodied, I move through the world like them. And I, even though I haven't like done any of the medical transition or whatever, I am most comfortable with a large group of trans women, and we have a ton of fun. Like, our experiences in the world are similar because in a lot of ways, especially like in the work world. I've been very successful in the work world in some high-powered positions that often aren't achieved by cis women. We tend to not be in boardrooms. Like, there's a very limited group who are in there. And so I've had much more male experiences, I guess, in that way. Also have, you know, a lot of my work has been research and statistic oriented and the more math-based stuff. So when I'm hanging out with a group of trans women, it's like I can finally relax because nobody's immediately looking to try and judge what my gender is. And in a lot of spaces, and especially out in public, people have a hard time reading me even when I'm presenting as high femme because of my height, because of my shoulder width. I'm built like a linebacker, right? And so especially if I'm wearing a turtleneck or something, I can see everybody looking for the Adam's apple, looking for the giveaways that, you know, I was assigned male at birth or whatever. And I've been called sir since I was about 20 public. And then as soon as I speak, people feel really embarrassed, and it's never bothered me to be gendered as male. But yeah, for years people would go, oh, sir. And then like I'd start talking, they're like, oh my gosh, right? Especially when I had shorter hair and all of that. So being with a group of trans women just felt really normal to me. And it was so nice where none of that was an issue.
So fascinating. Okay. Shall we get to the space that we're here to talk about?
Let's get to the space.
So, Wicked Grounds. Do you remember the first time you ever went there?
Yes. Yes. So, Wicked Grounds, for folks who are not familiar with it, was a kinky coffee shop in the Leather Cultural District in San Francisco on 8th near Mission. And you would go in, and it was a regular coffee shop. You could get coffee and snacks, but they also had a bunch of queer and kinky books you could buy. You could buy collars and floggers. They had a small merch section. And they also offered things like if you identified as a pet, you could get your coffee in a dog bowl and drink it from the floor.
Oh,
Like it
wow.
was, and you know, they had a chair that was a St. Andrew's cross with a chair on it that you could sit. Like they appealed to the kink world. And it was a space where you could connect with community. And I went in, first time was probably about 10 years ago when I got back to California. I had been in New York and Maryland for a long time. And it was really built as this community space. And it's lovely to be around folks who are wearing things that signify the kink community. You'd have baristas wearing collars, or you'd have patrons in puppy mask or whatever. And then the ads that were up were like for Safe Word Taxes, which is a tax group that specializes in the adult industries. So you could come in there and be around other kinky queer people. It was very inclusive in that. And it was a very safe space. And all the art on the walls is kink centered and it's lovely. And it was like, oh, this is fantastic. Because I'd been in gay spaces, I'd been in queer centric spaces, but to have one that was both queer and kinky was like, okay, these are my people.
So, okay, tell me about that first time then. So it was about 10 years ago. You'd heard about the space before you went there. Do you remember the feeling of walking through the front door?
Yes, so when I walked in, it was just like I'm looking around and I see all of the art and the books and the floggers in the back and stuff, and it was just like it was just being able to relax. It was feeling like, okay, this is a very welcoming space. I don't have to mask any part of who I am in here. Yeah, so like I just grabbed a cup of coffee and just watched. And I watched everybody come in and out and do that. I was on my own and do their thing. It was like, okay, this is a space where I don't have to dress up and present in any one way to be accepted. I can just be here. I can read whatever weird thing I'm reading. And or I could pick up a book and other weird stuff. And it was just so nice and felt so inclusive. And things like when you go into it was an all genders restroom, which is great. But they had, you know, safer sex supplies. You could grab them if you need them. Like there was no judgment there for whatever your identity was. And the fact that for sex workers and for queer folks and for people who are kinky full time, that this was an acceptable space, as well as the newbie off the street, right? And people would be having conversations about, well, you know, how do you get into this world or whatever? And there were people there like having these intro conversations, and it was fantastic. It was just, it felt like home.
So let's pick up on this question because that's one I want to ask you. So you've just said people were in there saying, like, how do you get into this space? How did you get into this scene?
So I discovered kink along with sexuality and puberty. My first serious boyfriend bought me a pair of handcuffs at 14. And
Were they the handcuffs with the pink fluffy trim?
no,
The
these were
proper
police
ones.
handcuffs, proper handcuffs. And we used to go mountain biking back up into the San Jose Hills. And then, like, he'd handcuff me and fist me. And I thought this is what everybody did before they had
Wait, wait, wait,
sex.
wait, wait. How old were you? Just so we're like clear on the context.
It's like 14.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, it felt good. It felt right. And then when I came out to my folks, I also started going to the LGBT bookstore, and I started finding they did have a small erotic section. And I'm like, oh, so there's a lot of people who do this, and there's a lot of women who do this. Okay. And then by 16, I was familiar with, you know, dykes on bikes and leather dykes, and I connected fairly early with that. And then at 18, I went to New York for the first time and I discovered the Vault, which was a big dungeon club in the meatpacking district when the meatpacking district still had meat warehouses. And so, like, I'm 18 and I have my fake ID and I'm walking through the meatpacking district, and it's literally like these giant delivery trucks with these bars going across the street, and they're sliding pig carcasses and stuff into the warehouses. And then you go up and you knock on this black door and go in. And it was like, Oh, there's a whole world here.
Wow.
And from then I was just kind of very connected to it.
But and there's going to be some questions that I ask that might be like a bit wrong and might be laced with assumptions. So sorry if I'm going to go in a weird direction. There is absolutely overlap between the lesbian scene and the kink scene, but there's also some stigma in the lesbian scene about people who are involved in kink. Potentially, you're nodding, so that's good. I'm not completely off base. How did you navigate that?
The lesbians I connected with and the queer women I connected with were often kinky women. And part of that, what drew me to it, is they were willing to talk about sexuality and desire and bodies and the body politic in a way that a lot of other queer women I was coming in contact didn't want to talk about. And I liked the fact that it was grounded in being okay with your body and who you are, because that's something I struggled with for a very long time, is like there's a lot of my body that I did not like, that I thought was wrong, that I wanted to change. And so being with women in a space where they're like, no, you are totally okay who you are beautiful for who you are, and part of your journey is learning to love these different parts of you that you don't like, and doing it in all these weird ways that felt really good. It was really helpful for connecting me with myself. Because when I was, especially in my teen years and early 20s, I felt very disconnected from my body and very not okay with how I looked and how I presented, and trying to figure that out. And the kink world allowed that exploration. And yeah, there is a lot of stigma around it, but even today, there's a lot of stigma around sex work. A lot of people view people who engage in sex work as somehow victims or not educated or whatever. But getting connected, especially in my 20s, with people who were doing this as work, as a choice, really shaped how I viewed how sexuality could be, right? It could be negotiated, it could be consensual, it could be on your terms. And if you can't find somebody like that, you could hire somebody like that to teach you these things. And understanding that there were women out there willing to teach me about this type of stuff was phenomenal. And they were incredibly powerful, strong, beautiful women. And it was like, oh, you're having the conversations I want to have, so let's just hang out.
Okay. So then it was kind of just a self-selecting thing, and you didn't tend to hang out with lesbians that had a stigma or a shame around kink.
Yeah. When I was in college, there was in the US, we have the or had the Michigan Women's Music Festival,
Oh, yeah.
which was this huge music festival where hundreds of thousands of women would get together and listen to all sorts of female musicians and have parties at night and all of that. And when I was in college, there were a couple of big conversations going on around that. One was the appropriateness of having leather women there, because leather women party differently. We enjoy different things. And people didn't want women enjoying getting spanked or flogged or whatever. They felt that was inappropriate in a women's space, where leather women were doing this consensually. So there was that conversation. And the other conversation is whether or not trans women should be included. And I always fell on the side that, of course, they should be included. But seeing those fights go on in the community really kind of set up some clear lines of what people were defining as womanhood, what people were defining as feminism, and really shaped how I wanted to approach my own feminism and how I moved through the world. And I saw feminism as much more inclusive than exclusive. And so, like, the whole conversation of, well, at what point can a trans woman come? Does she have to be fully medically transitioned, or what is feminine energy? And all of these questions, for me, seemed absurd. Right? Gender never made sense on the binary to me, so it helped me in my own exploration. But watching conversations like that made it very clear what I wanted my own feminism and my own manifestation of that to be. And so it helped very early start moving into these groups that were much more accepting of a wider understanding of sexuality, of feminism, of community.
But it so I don't really understand. Can you help me understand a bit more what the arguments were about not having leather women at the Women's Festival? And I just need to say as well, before we go into that, like, I also think that the arguments around not having trans women are ridiculous, but those have been played out quite a lot. So I kind of understand where people are coming from, and I'm not trying to just dismiss it and move it out of hand. Sorry, I'm over-explaining. So women who are into leather not being allowed, what was the main argument?
So the argument was that they were manifesting violence against women in the type of sex and play that they enjoyed.
Okay.
By engaging in different types of pain play, in different types of role play, people saw this as manifesting the patriarchy, right? That you could hit a woman. Even though this was on consensual, negotiated terms, they still saw it as violence against women. And there was some pushback, too, because leather is an animal product. And there was a big group of vegetarians who said, well, that's manifesting more violence against the world by bringing leather into this. And that we don't want to be exposed to women hitting each other and wearing leather and all of this, because that's just more violence and more manifestation of the patriarchal dominant hierarchy without ever understanding what it meant to that group. Because on the outside, some kink play, it's hard to distinguish between, is this abusive or is this consensual?
Yeah.
And you have to understand the dynamic between the people. And it was, you know, a group saying, we don't want to have to understand that dynamic. We don't want to have to accept that dynamic or have that conversation. It looks like abuse, therefore it is abuse.
Yeah. Or even just be like, yeah, go and do it on this side of the field and don't come near us whilst you're doing it. Like, that just seems like a good compromise, right?
Right.
How strange. Okay. So that's kind of answered the first part of my question, which is about this overlap between the women's scene and the kink scene. We've also talked briefly, and I want to explore a bit more, the overlap between, well, not overlap, the exclusionary views of some men in the kink scene who don't want women to be involved. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about your experiences in respect to that.
So that tends to come, my experience of that has come mostly from gay men who want gay male spaces. And I understand wanting a space to connect with people that you are comfortable with, right? I've been in all women's spaces. I've been in all men's spaces. And there are people who want to connect with people on the exclusive basis of gender, however they define that. And so that's where I've gotten some pushback of women don't belong in these spaces. In the leather bar that I frequent in Sacramento, for a long time, it was a fear that if we let women in, we're going to have to let all the heterosexuals in and we'll lose a gay space. And that was part of the issue, is that, well, if the women are here, even if they're queer women, the straight men will come and we don't want to lose a queer space. I get that. I will get wanting to keep queer spaces alive and queer. And in Sacramento, especially at the time that conversation was going along, a lot of the mainstream gay dance bars were being taken over on weekends by bridal parties and bridal shower parties with straight women coming in and really not respecting the space of the club and manhandling the gay men and stuff. And it was really not okay. So I get that pushback. Anymore, I don't see it as much now as I used to. Even at like the large international Mr. Leather competition, there's a ton of women who show up and are part of that and are part of that community. Tons of women producers and stuff. So that's really opened up a lot more. But yeah, a lot of that came around wanting to keep gay space, gay space.
And what do you think changed?
I think women got in and they realized that a lot of gay guys realized that they could still do all the weird gay stuff that they wanted to. And that gay leather women were going to respect that space. They may still not want the heterosexuals there, but as long as it stays a queer, like, you know, I started showing up and then a few other leather women started showing up and it was like, this was a bar where you used to go around the corner and give each other blowjobs and stuff. And none of us would complain. You're like, yeah, you know, boy's going to go have fun. And so when that became clear. It was like, okay, so gay women are okay in this space, you know. If they're going to be accepting and open to that, sure. Like,
If you're fine with me having a quick BJ, then you can stay.
yeah. Or be, have you tried this little tip? And they're like, yes, you can stay. That helped the BJ.
Oh, what, you're just giving out BJ tips. I never call it a BJ. I don't know why I'm calling it a BJ so much today. Sorry. Do you have any that you can share?
You have to play with the balls. So many people just focus on the tip or the shaft, but you got to get the boys involved.
I don't know.
No?
I mean, yeah, I don't really care if my balls get touched or not. But I do appreciate this as a tip because I do think a lot of people do.
Well, and things like licking and sucking on them and stuff as part of it to kind of get the whole area involved. For a lot of men, especially at the beginning, that helps with arousal.
Yes, good point. Good point. But if anyone's listening and we get into a situation where you might be giving me a BJ, just don't. Please and thank you. Okay, so we started talking about Wicked Grounds and then we moved off from Wicked Grounds. Can you tell me a bit about the time of your life? So you just moved back to California. What was going on for you?
So I moved back to California to take a job with the state of California. I was finishing up grad school and I had done a few interviews to teach, and it became very clear that I did not want to be a university professor. I loved the teaching, and just everything else that went with it was not so fun. So I moved to California to work in research for the state. And as my research evolved, I started doing a lot of work on the needs of women veterans and like military sexual assault and stuff. And so doing kinky things in the Sacramento community was not necessarily safe politically for me. Like, I didn't want pictures getting out of me playing or anything because it's very hard to have a conversation when I'm testifying for Congress about the problems of military sexual assault if I'm pictures of me tied up somewhere and having fun. So I started going to San Francisco to connect with the community there and put a little distance. So Wicked Grounds became a safe space because I could be in streetwear and just hanging out and around my community without ever running the risk of this getting back to my bosses or to anybody I'm testifying before and stuff. So it became a safe space for me just to feel connected to community, to meet folks there. Without risking any part of my career.
And this is going to seem like an obvious question. Why was it important to feel connected to your community?
For me, it's really grounding and reminds me of why I do the work I do. For a long time, when I was working in research and in public policy and stuff, a lot of that feels futile. It takes years or decades to see your work manifest. And so much of it I couldn't do because we're just not, it wasn't the right political timing to move on different issues and have these conversations. So connecting with my community and reminding me, okay, we need to keep pushing the ball down the field. We need to make the world safer for other people. And we need people who actually appreciate me in my fullness and not this suit running around talking about these things. Was very grounding for me, and that it's still okay to be who I am, even though my job said most of who I am is not okay. To work as a political researcher and all of that, I had to have all nonpartisan views. I couldn't come down on yes or no on any one policy issue or because of the dictates of the positions I held. And so to be able to connect with people and say, okay, let's talk about the reality of this. I can have opinions. I can look this way. I can be this way. So for me, that was really connecting. Just having people who I can talk to about something other than, hey, SB, whatever through the Congress and what you're going to vote on, right? I can actually talk about things that I enjoy was delightful.
So in that, this is probably going off topic and it's not necessarily, I should have just asked the question.
That's okay.
When you're in that position of not being allowed to form an opinion or not being able to stand your ground in respect to certain things. How do you not let that completely eat you up inside?
It did. It did. And that's why after about a decade in that work, my body literally shut down and prevented me from doing it anymore. I became fully disabled. And in a period of 6 months, I went from completely able-bodied to bedridden. And it's taken me almost a decade to crawl out of that hole.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. No, I was really doing my best to manage the stress. I was going to the gym. I was eating right. I was trying to take some time off. I mean, I was working about 90 hours a week on average the last 2 years I was there. But even with all of the work I tried to do to stay everything in balance, my body completely shut down and I couldn't do it anymore. And it forced me to change my career to something that's much more in line with who I am.
Wow. I'm like such a slow learner, but I'm at a point now where I'm realizing that when my values are called into question, it's just so destabilizing to me. And there's no way for me to really meaningfully navigate through that. I'm just like, fuck yous all, fuck this, fuck everything, which probably isn't the most productive thing. But yeah, I can't imagine having to just swallow things that you would have had to swallow in that position and being in that role. Where were we before that?
Good grounds.
But, and what was happening in your personal life then?
So I had recently divorced. I'd been with my ex for 12 years and she and I are still friends. She's one wonderful person. We just were not a good partnership at that point. So I divorced. I was starting to look at getting back out into the dating scene, which is challenging, especially when you're older.
Is that just a general statement about dating becoming more and more difficult as you get older, or is that specific to you?
For me, it was specific to me. Mm-hmm. The last time I had dated was 13 years before when I met my partner, and I was much younger, much thinner, less gray. And so, you know, we're all given these messages that to be attractive, to be desirable, you have to fit into a certain physical type. Yeah. And I wasn't that. So to come to terms with, okay, and I've been divorced and, you know, I have all this baggage now that I didn't have in my 20s. And how do I go back on the scene and dating scene and then navigate apps, which were not around the first time I dated, right?
Even if they had been, they're just terrible and they're not going to really be very helpful.
Right. You actually had to know some coding to use any app that was around the last time I dated. And now any idiot with a computer can do it. So it was very overwhelming and intimidating to go back out and start dating and even knowing what I wanted.
Yeah.
Right? I had been in a relationship for 12 years and I knew what I didn't want. But knowing what I wanted was a whole other thing I had to discover.
And does your partner need to also be into kink?
No. For a long time, I thought, yes, I'll just look in the kink world. My current partner is not. My current partner had all the red flags. He was straight. He didn't know many gay people. He was not into kink. I had never pictured long-term relationship with a heterosexual cis man not into kink. Like, that just wasn't on the table. And we met at a poetry reading of all things.
Aww.
But there was something about him that I literally chased him down after the reading to get his phone number. And he's turned out to, we've been together for 8 years now. Aww. And it's been absolutely wonderful and surprising. And I have been a huge learning curve for him as he has been for me. Like, I'm like, oh my God, straight men think like that? Like, it kind of blows my mind because I haven't been around a lot of them for a very long time. But it's been a wonderful journey with him. So yeah, we've made it work and he's learned things and I've learned things and we're 8 years in and going strong.
So I have to admit, when we were talking before and I was saying like, oh, you know, are men... like, do men have problems with women? You were like, mm-hmm. Well, that's my experience with gay men. And I was like, oh, yeah, they're a straight man.
I kind of forget about about them when they're not in your world on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's like the first time that's ever happened to me. But I was just like, oh, of course. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. One of the other things you said was that when you were getting into dating, you had been divorced. Did you find mm-hmm. that people like had opinions and thoughts and judgments around that when you were starting to date?
Some. I did come across some folks that were concerned that I was still carrying a torch for my ex or baggage.
Okay.
That came up. I met a lot of folks who were much closer to their divorce than I was. Like, I started dating about 18 months after my mm-hmm. divorce. A lot of folks who had been divorced for a month or two had a very different reaction to their partner and what they wanted to talk about and stuff. So that was a little difficult navigating. And then I came across quite a few people who were concerned that because I'd been married in the past, I'd want to get married again rather rapidly in the future and want that commitment again.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm like, no, I will never combine my money with anybody else again. I learned my lesson the first time.
Oh, I'm not going to ask follow-up questions there. My whole body is screaming to ask follow-up questions, but I'm not.
It's very expensive to get divorced, and it's very hard to untangle assets. And I learned that because when you're young and naive and in love with a beautiful woman, of course it seems like a reasonable decision to combine your bank accounts and your retirement accounts and purchase homes together. And now I wouldn't do that again. I like having control of my own money and my own credit score.
But yeah, all of our systems are geared up for this very old-fashioned way of the world working, which the world does not work in anymore. And it just doesn't really make any sense why we haven't had reform in all of these areas. But yeah, that's maybe not appropriate for this conversation. So do you remember? Okay, well, so actually, first of all, why did Wicked Grounds close?
So San Francisco has, their business base has been shifting. Mm-hmm. So several years ago, before the pandemic, they created the Leather Cultural District, which is this area where the leather community has always kind of been big and important, and our major organizations and stuff mm-hmm. are there. And we have cultural districts in different cities around to recognize the contribution of different groups. And when that was formed, Wicked Grounds was going very strong, had enough street traffic to support it. And at the time, Starbucks wanted to come in and put in a coffee shop in the Leather District. And Wicked Grounds fought back. And it's the only time in the U.S. where a Starbucks has been denied a permit to build. Which was great. So they were able to keep it going. And then as the pandemic hit, of course, street traffic and the ability to stay open fell. And San Francisco had some of the most restrictive opening laws and were the last to open. So it reduced that. And with that, then the whole area, quite a few shops begin to shut down and rent is astronomical. San Francisco is one of the most expensive places in the world to live, let alone rent business space. And so as more and more stores in the area closed down, the margins that they were working on were very slim. And so they had to become a virtual space and go online to maintain it because they just couldn't generate the income to stay open with the rising rents and the decreased traffic.
But, and do you remember hearing about it closing? And what was your response?
So they had played with closing in, I believe it was 2021, closing the space, because we were peak pandemic at that moment. And there was this huge outcry, not only from people in the San Francisco area, but because so many folks, when they come into town, this becomes one of the places that they go, right? So the owner, Mir, started a Patreon account where you could donate like monthly to help keep going. And they were able to raise enough money to keep it open and keep it going. as rents has continued to go up, however, that was not enough to sustain them with the reduced income in the physical space. So when they decided to close down, there was a, you know, this whole connected community, and a lot of us are online and stuff, who were very sad about it, but also recognized that it's just not financially feasible for small businesses to stay open.
So what was your response?
I was devastated. I was so sad to see them close. Like, I understood. I get it, but it was like it's losing kind of a cornerstone of the community, and it's just a real loss. I feel a real loss. And every time I drive past the exit, because I would get a cup of coffee before I drive back up home after I taught and stuff, it's like, oh, I miss it. I miss that connection. And there's a push, you know, and not only by me, but by a lot. We would love to have a physical space to go and connect with people, but I think most of us, including me, are realist and understanding that making $15,000 a month to pay the rent before you pay staff or anything else is absurd. Like on coffee, you know, even at $5 a cup, it's an absurd amount to raise.
So what do you think San Francisco has lost?
I think they've lost a safe space for the kink community. It was a space where people went, including me, to connect. There were plenty of folks who went there and would have questions like, what is aftercare? Or I had a bad scene, or I had a bad date. Can I talk to somebody? Can I vent? It was a safe space to have conversations about what was going on in my life or one of my friends' lives that you couldn't have in other coffee shops. Like at Wicked Grounds, I could go in and say, oh, yeah, I went out with this guy and we did this weird shit and this went to the left or to the right, you know. That's not a conversation I'm going to have in your average coffee shop because the other patrons are going to be very uncomfortable. So it's a loss of a place to go and do that. And it's a loss of a community space. It's really quite sad. I mean, I think a lot of us, including me, feel like, okay, so where do we go to initially connect? Because there are munches and there are clubs and all of this, but this was a space where you could talk about sex and kink, but you didn't have to be enjoying sex and kink at the time. Like that didn't have to be the focus. You could literally just go there to read or get a cup of coffee. And so having kind of a broad-based space like that really feels like a loss of almost a safety net in the community there.
And so on a personal level, what have you lost?
I've lost a space to go and connect with my community in the Bay. Like, there is not another physical location that I go to connect with my community down there, right? There are places I may go to play, there's places I may go to teach, but that just general kind of safe connection and space to be who I am is gone. And there's nothing else like it.
So, to wrap up, I like to get a bit cheesy before I let you back out into the world. What did that space teach you about yourself?
That there are spaces, physical spaces that make it okay to be me, right? It's not just this ethereal, emotional space, right? But there are physical spaces in the world where you can exist in your full, messy humanness, and that's okay. But those are very rare. Very important, but very rare.
And what are the ingredients that are present for that to exist?
For me, it's seeing different parts of me reflected in the space. And that can be by artwork, that could be by, you know, various pride flags, whatever it is. That, and by the people seeing a broad range, because none of us are just a single thing. I'm not just a single thing. I'm not just kinky. I'm not just queer. I'm this whole messy set of things. And seeing people reflecting different parts of that in the same space and being comfortable there really is what created it. And for me, books. Books will always be. You gotta have books. I'm so, it's just part of who I am. And they had that, right? I have a hard time feeling at home in any space if there's no books. I'm big on the old John Waters advice. If you go home with somebody and they have no books, don't fuck them.
But you've made all the effort. You're already there. I mean, just don't see them a second time is what I think.
Their ball gags exist for more than one reason. Sometimes it's just to keep them quiet.
Do you have any memories of Wicked Grounds or clubbing from your own scene that you want to share? Well, if you do, please get in touch. I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing and spaces and being, but I need your help. Go to lostspacespodcast.com, find the section, share a lost space, and then tell me all about what it is you got up to. You can also reach out to me on Facebook or Instagram if you would rather. My handle on both is Lost Spaces Pod. Find out more about Auntie Vice by listening to the Fat Girls on Top podcast, available wherever you stream podcasts, or following her on Instagram at Auntie Vice, or you can also visit her website, AuntieVice.com. If you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you took the time to subscribe, leave a review on your podcast platform of choice, or just told other people who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen too. My name is Kay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces.